Oui.
Welcome to Headlines. This is David Lichtenstein. This week we will be speaking about Emunah. It is a topic we don't speak about enough, not among ourselves, not to our children. And it's a very important topic. We have with us an educator, a machanach, one of the great speakers of our generation, Rav Yosef Yitzchak Jacobson. He's the Rosh HaMedabrim B'chol Mokim, and he's taught and spoken in almost every possible, framework here in the United States, on campuses and yeshivas he's spoken, by Pesach events, by Sukkot events. Really, it's an honor to have him with us. And we'll also be having with us Rabbi Yisrael Chaim Blumenthal, who heads an organization. He writes, responses and videos. You can get him on the internet discussing missionaries, which is something that not necessarily we struggle with, but he says in Eretz Yisrael, many people struggle with it more than here. You can listen to us Matzah Shabbos from 11 to 12 midnight on WMCA 570 AM or on the Nachum Siegel Network or on WMCA.com. Monday morning at 11 AM on NachumSiegel.com. You can find all our shows at www.headlinesbook.com under the audio podcast section, or you can call in to listen to the shows at 732-806-8700. You can email any questions, comments, ideas. I'd love to hear what do you think I or we should be discussing. info@headlinesbook.com. So this week, we start the Torah anew. We read from Bereishis, and here is the first sin that happens in the Bria, the first chait that goes wrong. What is it? It says, when the Rabbeinu Shalom, when God says to the world, he says, he commands the earth to create a Shem, when God makes the commandment for a fruit tree, he says, Eitz pri ose pri, let the earth emit a fruit tree that creates that fruit. So Rashi asks, what does it mean, Eitz pri ose pri? It seems a little bit duplicative. So Rashi says, a fruit tree that produces fruits. So Rashi says, in the beginning, originally the intent was that the tree itself should have a taste of fruit. The bark should taste. And, we actually have a fruit like that. The esrig, the bark of the esrig tree has like an astringent, citrusy flavor, just like the esrig itself. Pre-Eitz Hadar, what does Rashi say? Rashi says, Ktamo Eitz Ketama Pre. So the question is, what was the intent that the bark, the fruit, the tree itself should have the flavor of the fruit? When you think of it, what is a tree? A tree represents, a tree farm. The tree is the infrastructure, it's the factory, it's the framework which to create fruit. And when you put it back to man, because Adam ate Sasada, it represents our work, our effort, all the, energy we put in to create fruit, to create a result. Going to work to come home with the paycheck. Going on a diet to look good. Spending time with our children so that one day we'll have nachas from them. So it's the factory that creates the fruit. That's what the tree represents. It also represents the potential, the possibilities. When we look at the barren trees before they begin to fruit, undeveloped, unrealized, look at all the potential. What type of crop will I have this year? So initially, the intent was the tree itself should have the flavor. And what does that mean? Between potential and what we actually produce, between the spoon and the mouth, between, we're just coming off of Rosh Hashanah, think of all our commitments. Health, I'm going to lose weight. Yom Tov, I don't know about for you, for me it's brutal. It's 5 pounds. We're going to get into shape. We're going to take a walk every day. We're going to do exercise. At work, we're going to do a better job. We're going to have bigger ideas, better dreams, better thoughts with our children, We'll spend more time with them, with the people we love. I'll treat them better. We'll be more sensitive for men. We'll listen, either for the first time or better. These are all the potential. The fruit that comes out afterwards, about weight, work, relationships, maybe it's not so good. So the Torah gives us a hint. It says if you want the tree and the fruit to be more, you know, iterative, where the result is more, can be tied back quantitatively, qualitatively, in a more concrete fashion, the Torah gives us a hint. Make sure that the tama eitz, the fruit flavor, is in the tree too. That the effort, that the journey, is seen as something joyful and flavorful as well. Is the journey just something we have to, an undertaking? Is it the daily grind, the chores that we have to do? Or can we find some flavor, meaning, is the journey maybe an end in itself? Is that even possible? You know, a nurse, I have daughter-in-law, she's a nurse. It could be a daily grind, right? Or it could be an opportunity to bring relief to people who are always in pain. Nobody goes to the nurse because they're feeling well. Is a teacher, is it my occupation, my livelihood? Or as a teacher, am I developing young minds? Am I giving them dreams, vision, self-confidence, which are really the bedrock of our society? What are household chores? Washing dishes, cleaning, horrible. Or is it really creating a home, building a place for harmony? Is it the blank slate upon which the fertile ground upon which beautiful things can happen? Minds, people, love, relationship. So can the Torah is telling us, and if we want to, if we want that diet to be successful, if we really have to eat the broccoli and we could hold our nose like President Bush did, hated it and swallow it, or we can go online and see, it's just been discovered, broccoli has some chemical MNM which allows people, gives the longevity is tied to broccoli. Health, feeling good, being fit, having vigor, staying young, keeping the gray out of your hair. That's what all the things a diet will do for you. You know, I saw a story. There was a party, an affluent event, you know, and a mixture of people. So there was a fellow, he ran a hedge fund. And, you know, very matter-of-fact, driven, results. You know, they mark their book to market every single day. I mean, there's no journey there. It's every day. It's like tachlis. So he's at the party, and there were a few people speaking. So he said to this woman who was speaking, he says, oh, I run a hedge fund. What do you do? She said, I'm a teacher. And he looked at her, and he didn't say it, but it was obvious. Oh, a teacher. And he tried to turn around like, I'm not spending my time talking to people. Like, just a lowly teacher. So she said, excuse me, what do you do? I'm a hedge fund. I run a hedge fund. A big hedge fund. So she said, so you spend your days trading paper from one side of the desk to the other side of the desk, try to see where is there a mispricing, where is there a mistake that you could take advantage of, and at the end of the day, come home with a, you know, real vig. He says, let me tell you what I do. I go to school every day, and I see these beautiful young children, and when their eyes look at me, they sparkle, and they're curious, and they want to learn about themselves, who they'll be, what they'll do, what's their purpose? And I try to maintain and nourish that curiosity, and I water it. And at the end of the year, if I was successful, 25 beautiful minds have left my class, more confident, more curious, learned, enlightened, better people, foundations of our society. I built 25 beautiful people. What did you do? You push paper and make money. How pathetic. That's someone who sees the beauty of the journey. What does the Torah say? The Torah says, Loi alecha hamalacha ligmar, the mission in Avos, the oracle says in Avos, it's not your job to finish. The journey itself is beautiful. Do you know that the Rav Shulchan Aruch, the Baal HaTanya, writes that there's two mitzvahs of Talmud Torah. One is to know the Torah. The other, the learning itself. The journey itself is beautiful. And it's based on a Gemara. The Gemara says there were two Talmidim learning. One said, Vahaftas Hashem Alekecha. He was learning next to somebody ignorant who said, Vayeftas Hashem Alekecha. In Aramaic, that means you should hate God. And the Torah says, the Gemara says, they're both Mekayim, Talmud Torah. It's a journey. The journey itself is the fruit. There's a Jewish psychologist in Stanford University, a brilliant psychologist, Carol Dweck, from the great Sephardi Dweck family. And she wrote a book called Mindset. And I read through it. And her theory is, she says, there are two types of mindsets. There are those mindsets of people who say, I know, I'm smart, I'm brilliant, I'm tall, I'm handsome, I'm beautiful, proud of who they are. And she said, there's the learning mindset. People who say, I'm learning, I'm growing, I'm creating. Not who I am, but what I'm, the process. And so she took 100 kids and she put them in two classrooms. The kids who were the smartest in the class, always known, that's the Eloi, the genius, the bright, the one the parents were proud of. And she gave them a puzzle. They did it very quickly. And she put the kids who were interested in learning, not bright kids, but hardworking kids, and they did a puzzle. Then she gave them each class a very hard puzzle. The smart kids looked at the puzzle and they walked away. They wouldn't do it. Because if they couldn't do it, that meant they're not smart, they're not brilliant, they're not the top, they're not the beloved. They lost their halo. The hardworking kids, one kid rolled up his hand and he said, wow, a challenge. I can't believe it. I love a tough challenge. Because people with the growing mindset, they can never be defeated. There's no failure because it's not the fruit at the end, it's the process. So if they tried hard, that itself makes you successful. The journey is beautiful. So that's a real indicator to later in life, will you be willing to take risk? Only people who can take risk really actually get a modicum of success. If you want to just stay in your hole and do whatever you're safe with, never stretch, never grow. It's not the Jewish way. But the only way one can take on risk is if I fail means, wow, I'm not the smart, I'm not the learned, I'm not the beloved, my parents don't love me. You can't take that risk. That's too much risk. If you say, it's my effort that I'm applauded. Everybody knows I give 100%. It's not important if I fail. You gave 100%. And why is this relevant? We all have children, students, friends. We can child and say, wow, you're a genius. And you know what you're telling your child? You're telling your child that if you don't do something so well or if you fail, I may not even love you anymore. Or you can tell your child, wow, you put out 100%. That's fantastic. And you know what? Maybe that child is yourself or myself. How do I look at my effort? Is it the result? The effort. If I applaud myself on my effort, failure doesn't scare me because there is no failure. I've already eaten the fruit. But if I applaud the result, oh my goodness, that's very frightening. Tam ha'etz ketam ha'pri. It's right after Rosh Hashanah, right after Yom Kippur. We're starting the New Jersey. We went out into the sukkah. We packed up into the tent. Mashiv ha'ruach, like the Rishon has said. Enough davening. Now, Moirid HaGeshem, he says, now we have to start our journey with Gashmias, those of us who work. Now's the journey, right? We have 6 months now, besides our regular, but actually we have to work now. What's the first thing the Torah says? Enjoy the journey. If the Tam HaEitz is Kitam HaPri, the likelihood of seeing the Pri is that much greater. Let's go to our guest.
Have with us on the phone Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Jacobson, the famous speaker. I think it's fair to say that he's the Rebbe Yehuda, the Rosh HaMedabrim of this Dayer, from Muncie, New York. Welcome, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak.
Thank you. It's an honor and pleasure to be with you.
You know, I had a pshat once. I heard a pshat that says Rebbe Yehuda was Rosh HaMedabrim b'chol mokim. Shaila is why. So they say Rebbe Yehuda ha'yenoisim b'hem simonim, the tzach adash b'achav. Somebody who could speak succinctly becomes Reish HaMedavrim B'chol Mokim.
And somebody who could make from 10 markers 3 markers.
Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, you speak frequently in front of non-religious audiences. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
Is it fair to also say that you also speak frequently among audiences that come from, you know, Anash, but because of their exposure to the world, struggle with questions that they may have not been addressed as they were growing up? Is that also fair to say?
Indeed, very often.
So I would like to say over, the reason we would like to have you on the phone, I once heard over from Rav Bick, the Chayin Lavrach, he said, one of the chiyuvei ha'aval ben, the obligations of a father to his son, is lasitei b'mayim, is to teach him how to swim in the water.
Right.
So Rav Bick asked, he said, in Eretz Yisrael, there's no water practically. It's a desert. He said, Bavel, there was practically no water. I mean, what was there? There was one river that cuts through Bavel. He says, what's the lasi type of mayim that Chazal was so worried about? He said, Rav Bick said, if you give me permission, he says, I have a pshat. He says, the mayim is mayim rabim, goes under umas ha'olam. He says, it's a treifin of elt. The chiyuv of a father is to teach him how to swim in the mayim rabim of what's called the umos ha'olam, the kfiruf and the vel.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And the Sfasema says this. The Sfasema says, I believe, that it's the first mitzvah in kiddushin. The pasuk in Shirashirim says, mayim rabim lo yuchlu lechabes yasa'ava unaharis lo yishtefuha. But everyone gets stressed out by the mayim rabim, and our parents have to teach us how to navigate them.
So kids come home today, and assuming that they're somewhat exposed to a secular world, and one of the things they'll ask, or they don't ask, it's even worse when they don't ask, is, you know, Darwin says there's a theory of evolution. We read in our science book the section we're not supposed to read, or maybe they picked up a newspaper, and it says that the world is 1 billion years old, or 10 billion years old, or 20
right.
billion years old. How would you, as a bachanach, as somebody who speaks to thousands of people, how would you address these issues?
I'll tell you, I'll tell you how I will never address it. And I think it's very critical because from my experience over quite a few years of speaking, not to hundreds, but thousands and thousands of graduates of Talmud Torahs, Chadorim, Yeshivas, Batei Medrash, Koilalim, girls' schools, seminaries, high schools, Mesiftis, and so on and so forth. I learned, first of all, what not to say. What not to say is to ridicule the child, to denigrate the child or the bacher or the girl or the young man or the young woman for their question, to call them names, to denigrate them, to tell them that Jews never ask these questions, and somebody who asks such a question is a kofer, is an apikoidus, will not get olam haba, is excluded from the Jewish people, will be punished. It's stupidity, it's absurdity, it's ludicrous. Because what happens when we do that is two things. First of all, we're saying a lie. The child is asking a legitimate, curious question that's coming because Hashem, the Ribbono Shel Olam, gave him a brain, and he's asking a question. To ridicule that, I think, is absurd, and it's not fair to the person. What's even more important, and that is the critical issue. I was speaking to a group of graduates of yeshiva, very, very good yeshiva, and they had very serious questions. And I asked them, they were in their 20s, did you ever ask this question to somebody? And they said, yeah, we asked this in sixth grade or seventh grade. And what were you told? They were told that Jews never ask such questions. These questions are for Goyim, for Apikorsim, not for Jews. I said, no, did that take away the question? They said it didn't, but we were told that Jews don't ask this. So here's the key issue. If I tell my child, we don't ask these questions, am I eliminating the question from his mind? Am I cleansing his mind from the question? Am I making sure he has a chizuk and a munna as a result? Or perhaps it's exactly the other way around. When the boy came to me with the question, when the 14-year-old kid came to me with the question, it was 50% by him that Rabbi Jacobson has an answer, and maybe 50% or 40%, 30% that he doesn't have an answer. So he's going to ask the question. 50% the Rebbe, the Rosh Yeshiva, the Mashgiach, the Mashpia, the Mechanech, the Mora, the teacher, has an answer, and maybe another percent that they don't have an answer. Once I tell them, Seh, you know, I ask such a question. These questions are out of our world, out of the world of Torah. You know what happens now? Now he is convinced 100% that I have no answer. At least before, it was a suffix. Maybe I have an answer. Now he knows for sure I don't have an answer. So I now ask you, deep in our hearts, you think people who get that response grow up with deeper conviction, with deeper Yiras Shamayim, with more emunah, with a profounder sensitivity to the reality and the truth of Torah, mitzvahs, and Hashem? Or is it maybe the other way around? So I think the first thing is to ridicule, to denigrate, should never, ever happen. I'm not talking about a kid who's just trying to ruin a class and is just trying to be cynical for the sake of being cynical and is not interested in an intelligent conversation. I'm talking about somebody who's bothered by a question. I think it's a educational, religious, and Torah mistake to be mevatel them, especially in our times, especially in our day. Now, I may not know the answer. That's fine. Ich darf nicht wissen. Rashi could say, Lo yadati, eini yedeya mamelamdenu. Rava could say, Dvarim shamarti lefneichem tohu sein biyadi. The Beis Yisrael and said over from a Litvish Rav. I heard this from the Baron Reich in Lakewood, that state Eidus behoistiv somai betseise al eretz Mitzrayim svas lo yadati eshel. That Paroi was blown away by Yosef HaTzadik because every one of the Chartumei Mitzrayim right away had an answer. Right away knew the interpretation of the dreams. Yosef says, Bilodoi. I don't know. God knows. Eidus behoisiv somei betseis haletz Mitzrayim. What took Paroi so much? Why was Paroi so blown away by Yosef's wisdom? He says, svas lo yadati eshma. It was the first time I heard somebody say, I don't know. I don't have to have every answer to every question. But I could tell the child, let me research it. Let me look into it. Let me get back to you. Let me allow you to have a conversation with Ploini ben Ploini who can address it. Why don't we do this? I think it's a display of a very deep lack of confidence very often. You know, if you ask me a question, Reb David, if you ask me a question, and I have had this question when I was 10 or 15 and I repressed it, I get upset at you. You know why I get upset at you? Because you're triggering something that I'm trying to repress. Is it possible that sometimes we ourselves are being challenged by questions that may bother us consciously or subconsciously, and we're lashing out on the students? Yiddishkeit has nothing to be afraid of. People who have answers are never, ever afraid of questions. I always tell my Talmidim, people ask me, how do you know you're not in a cult? How do I know I'm not in a cult? People say, are we in a cult? I say, listen, the first thing is, whenever you're asking such a question, it's a good sign. A person who's in a cult doesn't ask too often, maybe I'm in a cult. The fact that you can question yourself is already a good sign. Number two, the key difference between emunas hayadus and a cult, from my perspective, from what I have learned, is this. In a cult, they are threatened by honest conversations, and especially conversations with people who are not in the cult. Why? Because the people may plant seeds in your mind and you may sober up from your intoxication. Emunah that is threatened, that is afraid of conversation, of a challenge, of a question, of a discussion, is very, very dangerous. Because basically what it means is that my entire basis of faith is dependent on me being secluded and me being locked up and my not having the ability for real conversation. So now I ask you, is this a religion worth sacrificing for? Is this a religion worth investing in? This is the message I'm giving to my boys or my girls when I respond in this way.
And it's fair to say.
It's fair to say that Avram Avinu, right, and we're called Bnei Avram, we say Magen Avram, Avram Oyhavi, what does it say about Avram? Mi Bara Ela, Avram was the first one to ask questions. Avram, Yiddishkeit is founded on our Av, who asked questions.
And asked questions, and had the courage to break the Getchkes in his father's home. The definition of a Jew is somebody who has uninhibited courage to break the Avodah Zarah of every generation. Where would Avraham Avinu be? Where would we be? Where would humanity be? Where would civilization be? If Avraham Avinu came home and started to ask Terach, who must have been a chash of a guy, asked him some intelligent questions, and Terach would say, we follow tradition. We don't ask questions. We follow tradition. Avraham Avinu said, no. I follow authentic tradition. I follow truth. I don't follow tradition that's based on manipulation, on blindness, on absurdity, on irrationality, on lies, on deception, on power. I don't follow that. I'm looking for truth. If there's a God, the definition of Hashem is truth. Chaysamay shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu Emes, as the Gemara says.
So let's get back to our questions, okay? So a boy shows up and he says, Rabbi Jacobson, you know, scientists say the world is 10 billion years old. How do you deal with that? How do you respond?
Well, the first thing is I would engage with this boy with a conversation. I would thank him for sharing his thoughts with me. I would welcome his thoughts. I would make him feel valued for the fact that he's thinking, that he has a question. And now the real question is, you know, what has he read? What information does he have access to? How curious he is, and really engage in a very intelligent conversation. There is a very expansive literature today about all of these issues, written by intelligent people, by people who have not had to run away from the Shulchan Aruch and of Torah because of science. On the contrary, they believe that true Judaism will never contradict true science, because science, in its ultimate sense, is the search for truth in the world. So if Yiddishkeit is true, science by definition cannot contradict Yiddishkeit, and Yiddishkeit by definition cannot contradict science. The Rambam even believes in Hilchus Yesodei HaTorah, in Mishnah Torah, that the path to Ava and Yira is through the study of natural science. Now, this doesn't mean that everything that comes out of a scientist's mouth is Kodesh Kadoshim. Of course not. By definition, science can't even speak in absolutes. But all of these discussions and dilemmas and challenges, the age of the universe, 15.3 billion years, the process of evolution, and so forth, or all the questions, you know, Matan Torah, Maimed Har Sinai, Am HaNifcher, questions of anti-Semitism, questions of, you know, modernity, of democracy, of, I mean, so Felt Mishtoiz Baruch Hashem, questions and problems and dilemmas. There is a tremendous amount on abundant literature. There are even various approaches. There are different sugyas in this, different mahalchim, different shittas in this, but it can all be addressed. You know, people, when we read in Time magazine or in the New York Times, every few years, the world, the universe is given another age. Evolution is considered an absolute truth with no loikaima l'shaila. There's no question. But when somebody starts researching the background of things, everybody knows, every real scholar will be moida that everyone is ultimately making speculations. That even the age of the universe, for example, so there are from scientists based on the Teferis Yisrael Shitta who want to explain the 6 days in different ways. Rabbi Arya Kaplan, Rabbi Yisrael Lipschitz, and Teferis Yisrael already suggested this, that the Vayerev Vayivoyker Yoy Mecha doesn't mean one day, it could mean something else. Okay, that's a Shitta. Dr. Gerald Schroeder wrote about this extensively in numerous books. He's an Orthodox scientist. Others, for example, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, believed many letters that he wrote about this, that after all of his studying and research, he never found real absolute scientific truth to be able to say that we could say bevados, based on our detection that the universe is this and this age. Haraya, they themselves constantly argue about this, and every few years come up with different conclusions and different rayas, which means that the rayas from a few years ago weren't that absolute as we make them.
So yeah, I think the disagreements among scientists today is more about, is it 15 billion or 10 billion or 20 billion? There's not a reputable scientist today who will tell you it's, you know, 5 or 10,000 years old.
Right. But nonetheless, everybody is astounded by the phenomenon that approximately 5,000 years ago, we have the first signs of human civilization.
That is true.
And that's a fascinating fact, because we're assuming, according to Lishitasam, that the world is billions and billions of years old, and we have to hear what that word means. You know, for us billions, we don't even realize what that means. An evolution for billions and billions of years. And Plutzlung, 5,000, around 5 or 6,000 years ago, which matches, of course, the Sipur Bria Sa'olam, according to the Messiah of Yiddishkeit, you know, there are the first signs of human creativity, of human civilization. So I think, you know, that's a pretty interesting a phenomenon that Akula Alma Maidi. Now, excuse me. You know, there's the discussion about the Mabul and the effect of the Mabul. There's the discussion about different theories. One is known as uniformitarianism. In other words, do we really have access to the information? We have to basically extrapolate and say that if climate conditions and pressure and other things were then as they are now, then we can determine certain results. There has to be a certain humility, I think, that people have to realize how much speculation is necessary in determining any of these supposed truths. I think a person who becomes aware of this, which you will not get in a basic article, when you're reading a documentary, for example, about ants, they'll tell you l'chatchila how ants evolved. Or you'll read about bears in Alaska, and they'll tell you bears moved to Alaska, you know, 150 million years ago. And that becomes a fact, because that's already ingrained in secular culture. So we read these facts, and I think it's important for the educated community and for the educated Jewish community to really scrutinize everything and go to the background of it and go to every supposed emes. And we'll always see that there's always, if this is the case, then this is an MS.
So do you find, Rabbi Yitzchak, do you find in your experience that when you talk to the college kids, or I shouldn't just say college kids, but those who are, they call them orthoprax, those who are sort of half sphakis in emuna, that for the most part, through this method, you're able to dispel their sphakis?
I think what happens is, I wouldn't say dispel, I would say I could try to demonstrate to them that a Jew who embraces Torah is not a crazy, irrational, blind fool who has taken what they like to call a leap of faith, or has accepted blind faith because of his grandmother's chicken soup. And they realize that it's not basically an argument between people who are blind and choose to be blind versus intelligent people. There is a perception today, and we are somewhat guilty in this perception. Many of our own boys who, so to speak, leave Judaism and, you know, explore the world of science, because when they grew up, all they heard was, you're not allowed to ask questions. So for them, it's a choice between the path of intelligent people who scrutinize, who inquire, who wonder, who are inquisitive, and the path of the faithful who just want to remain locked up. And my real goal is to dispel that. You know, ultimately, everyone has to make a choice. We all know that Hashem created a world, Olam, as the Gemara says, and Pesachim is Meloshen Helam. It's a concealed world. People have to make choices. And everyone makes that choice, and choice is fundamental to how God wanted, how the Ribbono Shel Olam wanted the world to run. But at least you should be open, I tell them, to the fact that the Rambam, Reb Sadia Gaon, Rashi the Rashba, the Beis Yosef the Arizal, the Baal Shem Tov the Vilna Gaon, Reb Chaim Volozhin the Baal HaTanya, the Chafetz Chaim and the Lubavitcher Rebbe, etc., etc., were not just all closed-minded people who liked their mothers and fathers and just followed the tradition. They had the courage that every scientist has to ask very real questions and to use the mechanism of the human mind, just like anybody else, maybe even more, and their conclusions were not based on dumbing down everything and locking out any real idea. I just want you to appreciate that. And often I'll tell you, it's a battle not on an intellectual level, but on an emotional level. Because if somebody for 10 or 15 years, the message they heard was, you're not allowed to think, you're not allowed to ask questions, it's very hard emotionally even for them to believe what I'm saying. Even if I could prove them to the vet, that even if I could prove it to them intellectually. So sometimes it's really a very deep emotional conversation. There are scars, there are wounds.
So, do you believe that they should teach this in yeshiva, or is it better, more reactive, at a point in time when, you know, questions arise, etc., it should be addressed on a one-on-one, sort of like a endarshin elabiechad, right? Endarshin ma'isim merkav elabiechad. Do we be reactive about this, proactive, discuss it in yeshiva, speak about Gerald Schroeder? What would be your sheet in it, your suggestion?
My suggestion would be as follows. We have to teach a Judaism that is not defensive. It's offensive. What do I mean? We have to give each of our children and students the resources and the skills and the confidence to know that Yiddishkeit never has to be timid. It never has to shy away from the world. If it's emes, it's emes in science and in physics and mathematics. Emes Hashem la'olam means, if Hashem is real and Torah is real, it's real on every level and it's real in every discipline. And a Jew ought to have that confidence of what Torah is. Or as the Zohar puts it, Estakel b'reiso bara alma. Torah is the blueprint of the universe. And when we say Torah is the blueprint of the universe, it means that the most intelligent and profoundest perspective on the universe, in all aspects, will ultimately be rooted in Torah. I think that confidence is deeply, deeply missing today. And when a child is confronted with a question or confronted with modernity, they often falter because we're not given that confidence. I'm going to give you an expression that there was a Yid, his name was Echad Ha'am. He was a famous, famous apikoidus from Russia. And he met a big gadol b'Yisrael, and he came out of his meeting and he said about this man, he said, Yoideya es ha'olam u'mechavin limrid boy. I heard it from Al Tichsin that it was the fifth Chabad Rebbe, the Rebbe Rashab, who was a cousin of his, a shtickle cousin of his, Echad Ha'am. Now,
I heard about there's a street in Yerushalayim named after him.
Yerchav Achadam. Yeah, he was a classic apikoidus. He was a literary genius.
And Rav Amram Bloy had a meeting on that street, and they say he was walking around Yerushalayim. He asked a few people, "Eifo Rechov Echad Ha'am Yemach Shemai." People didn't know exactly which street he was referring to. So continue. Go back to your point.
Yeah, what this means is, I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, every moysid, I think every moysid ultimately has to determine its curriculum. But two things, I think. Number one, when a child asks these questions, we have to address them. Number two, do we create a curriculum all around these questions? That I think every moysed has to establish based on its norms, based on its, based on what is best suitable to raise wonderful young Jewish men and women dedicated to Avos Hashem, Avos HaTorah, and Avos Yisrael. But I think the Tzad Hashavish Loi HaRezeh KaHareizeh, VeLoi HaRezeh KaHareizeh. HaTzad Hashavish HaBehen is that our Yiddishkeit that we give in our classrooms ought to be holistic. Marabu Ma'asecha Hashem Kulam B'chach Ma'asisa is not a pasuk that we should shy away from. The whole Yisoid that Hashem is not Elokei HaShemayim. He's Elokei HaShemayim and Elokei HaAretz. That Ein Oid Mulvadoi. That the truths of godliness you can find in the bee dance and in a flake of snow, in a blade of grass and in a running gazelle, in a grain of sand and in a black hole and a star. That fundamental approach of Kol Ma Shabara Kadosh Baruch Hu Baylam Elibray Ela Lechvoidoi. The Welt is a Get Lechazach. The world is God's home. And because the world is God's home, therefore from every nekuda, from every nuance, from every nook and cranny in the universe, you could find there a lekus, you could find the koyach hapoyel benifel. It's really the Dvar Hashem that is underlying its atomic structure. You know, I heard today, in the morning, somebody sends me a link to a young girl who grew up in one of the Orthodox communities, and then she left. She's 22. Today she's in university. And they asked her, why did you leave? She said, because I wanted to learn how an atom works. How an atom works. Now I ask you a question. Isn't the structure of an atom and the composition of sectillion atoms, millions, billions, trillions, sectillion atoms that make up a drop of water, isn't that one of the most divine, the greatest divine manifestations in our world? The organization, the symmetry, the structure, the depth. What about the dazzling brilliance of how a tree grows and protects itself and develops itself and ensures that it propagates and so on and so forth. And it takes sunlight and turns it into sugar through its leaves. Just to cite one example. What this allows a child is he goes out, he looks at a tree and he sees Hashem. He sees godliness, he sees Torah there. So I think our curriculum must finally stop creating a separation, a gulf, between the world of Abaya and Rava and the physical world that we encounter when we walk in the street. V'nigla kvoid Hashem v'roch al basa yachtov kipi Hashem diber, I think needs to start before Mashiach comes, so we can usher in an era of a universal consciousness. You know, the Baal Shem Tov used to teach that La'olam Hashem Dvar Chanitzav Bashamayim means that the core of every Nivra is the Dvar Hashem, and it recreates it. You know, today, we literally have oisius for it. When you say Basara Mamaris Nivra Ha'olam, today we know DNA, the miracle of DNA, that every cell contains within itself the entire genetic code of the entire organism. Every single cell, you have 50 trillion cells in your body. Every cell has in it the program for the entire body. And each cell has that DNA, which is basically letters. That's what they call it today, like a computer code, like a program code of letters. And that makes up the essence of creation. So I just think that there's an approach that would allow our children, our students, that when they should not feel that we're hiding, we're running from truth. On the contrary, you're given here a message that will empower you to be able to live the best life, the happiest life, and to be able to see the world in the most profound, truthful, deepest, and exciting way.
Rabbi Jacob Yosef Yitzchak, that was beautifully put. I'd like to thank you very much on behalf of our entire audience.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
cult of a good Shabbat. We have on the phone with us Rabbi Yisrael Blumenthal, who runs an organization, Judaism Resources, and he's frequently seen on the TVs, on the YouTube, excuse me, doing Jews for Judaism. Welcome, Rabbi Blumenthal.
Thank you for having me.
So, Rabbi Blumenthal, tell us a little bit about what you do, what your organization is, and how you counteract questions in Emunah.
Well, what I do is I deal with people that have problems coming from Christianity. These people have been influenced by missionaries. As of yet, I haven't encountered a firm person that has these problems, meaning someone who was from birth. Most of these people are people that grew up in secular or nominally religious, let's say conservative, reform, very little Jewish identity, that had been influenced by missionaries. And the missionaries gave them a slant on Tanakh, you know, different passages in Tanakh, how to read them, different questions against Judaism. And I write articles trying to answer them. I take missionary material and I respond to it. And so I've written articles that have been posted on, you know, different organizations' websites. But my blog basically is, you know, an archive of my articles on these subjects.
So how do you respond to, what is this, tell us some of the questions those who are influenced by missionaries ask you, and how do you respond?
So most of the questions fall into the category of scriptural, meaning to say is that they met a missionary who showed them a pasuk in Tanakh, often mistranslated, almost always taken out of context, and they want to, you know, they see this is a proof to some detail of Christianity, and they want to know what the Jewish response is. So my general approach is I tell them, okay, let's stop for a minute. Instead of asking ourselves what is the correct explanation of this particular passage, which we will get to when I eventually do get to that, but let's step back and ask ourselves, if you're pointing to this book and you want me to make a life-changing decision on the basis of this book, that means whoever wrote this book wants me to know that it's true and that it's, you know, inspired by Hashem, by God. And so how do we know that? What is the basis of our belief in Tanakh to begin with? That's I want them to think about that question. Another question I give them to think about is when you're reading Tanakh and you encounter the word God, which comes, it's the third word in Tanakh, Bereshis Bara Elokim. So are you supposed to know what that word means before you open the book, or is the book going to teach you what the word means? And I bring them to the idea of the concept of that the only way we know Tanakh is true is the testimony, the witness. Torah tziva lanu Moshe Mayrasha Kihilas Yaakov, that it's the witness of Klal Yisrael. Klal Yisrael are the witnesses that HaKadosh Baruch Hu appointed to teach us his truth. And one of the truths that we were appointed to teach is that the Tanakh is truly Hashem's word.
So would you say that for the most part, the missionaries, it's really just misplaced, mistranslated, and sort of a corruption of the understanding of Pesukim?
It's worse than that. In many cases, it's a misunderstanding, a local misunderstanding. You know, like the famous Yeshaya Zion Yadalit, what I call Isaiah 7:14, where they see a virgin birth and the word Besula is not there, the word is Alma. That's a local mistranslation. Not always is it a local mistranslation. Sometimes they get the local translation right, but it's always taken out of the context, the general context of Tanakh. That means if you look at the big picture of Tanakh and you ask yourself, what is the author trying to tell me with this book in general, not in this particular three words, but in the general picture of Tanakh, when the author is trying to make a point, what point is he emphasizing? And the message is clearly not Christian. It's anti-Christian. It's Jewish and not Christian. But the missionaries miss that. In fact, an example of a question. I tell people, when I'm speaking, right, so before I speak to somebody, I would like to know who my audience is. Is it going to be a group of sixth grade children? Are they going to be secular, religious, orthodox? Because I'm going to calibrate my words according to the audience. So you have to ask yourself before you start reading Tanakh, who is the target audience of this book? And they never thought of this question, but the answer is clearly there in the book. It's Mayrusha Kihilas Yaakov. It's for Klal Yisrael. It's not for the outside. It's not for the Goyish world. Magid Dvarav LiYaakov, Chukav Mishpatav LiYisrael. Hashem is speaking to Klal Yisrael. He's not speaking to anyone else. So the only correct way to read Tanakh is from the perspective of Klal Yisrael. And you have to read it as together with your ancestors before you and your children after you. You can't read it so much as an individual, but you have to read it together with Klal Yisrael. You have to read it with from our perspective, from our point of view, because we are the target audience.
Now, when you I've seen you've done many videos on YouTube. When people watch your videos who are, you know, Christians, Jews who may have been affected by missionaries, what is their reaction to your sort
well,
of your...
It's interesting. What is their reaction? It's a very diverse reaction. So, you know, some of them get very upset at me, and they believe I'm an agent of the devil. That's, you know, one extreme. And the other extreme is people actually contact me, usually through my blog, and want to learn more. And then there's many reactions in between. But obviously the goal is to get people thinking, to help them realize that there is another way of looking at it and to help them see through the missionary arguments, which often are really dishonest.
Give me an example of like a dishonest argument.
There's one that just came up today. I mean, the missionary probably posted it a while back, but it came to my attention today, is that... This is a classic missionary proof, quote-unquote, proof text, meaning to say is they point to Yeshaya Nun Gimel. Yeshaya Nun Gimel discusses how the servant of Hashem suffers and he's suffering for the sins of others. And that is a proof, quote-unquote, to the concept of what they believe in that Yashka did. He suffered for the sins of others. Now, the classic Yiddish Jewish interpretation is that it's talking, like Rashi says, it's talking about Tzadikei Yisrael, and we know that Tzadikim, Akash Baruch Hu, you know, brings Yisurim on the Tzadikim to be Mechaper on the door, and that's our interpretation. So this missionary argued, and what backs up our interpretation is that the word Eved, Avdi, which is used in that chapter, is earlier in Yeshaya refers to Klal Yisrael as a whole very clearly. So this missionary wanted to argue and say, well, yes, in the earlier chapters of, let's say, in from Yeshaya Mem through Memtes or Memches, in other words, from 40 to 48, yes, Yisrael and Yaakov appear, and he counted how many times Yisrael and Yaakov appear. But once you come to 49 to 53, so then the words Yisrael and Yaakov appear much less. So he's trying to say is that the Navi is moving away from a national focus and more on the individual focus. So technically he's correct that the proportion of Yisrael Yaakov slows down when it comes to those chapters, but the Navi uses many other terms to make it clear that he's talking about the nation. For example, Ami, or Am Tairasi Belibam, or Tziyain, or Yerushalayim. So he's lying, the missionary. He's basically... He's trying to present a portrait as if there's a shift away from the national focus to some individual focus, and he's just presenting part of the fact. He's saying, well, the words Yisrael appear less often, but he's not telling you that the words Tzion and Yerushalayim appear more often to make up for the lack of Yisrael and Yaakov.
So that's Rabbi Blumenthal, have you ever met a frumer person who's left, you know, Yadus because of a missionary? So is it? Would you say,
no?
Yeah, Rabbi Blum, would you say it's fair to say that the threat in our times is much less missionary and much more atheism and science?
Well, there's no question that atheism is much bigger numbers, but I will say this much: is that the secular Jew, and specifically in Eretz Yisrael, are being influenced by missionaries more and more. There's a terrible threat by missionaries, and it's being underrated very gravely. In Eretz Yisrael, basically, the media already has saturated the minds of the secular Jews against Yiddishkeit and from Yidden. So if they're looking for spirituality, that's not where they're going to go. there's a very positive feeling about America and the Western world in the secular society in Eretz Yisrael. And along come the missionaries, and they present an Americanized, sort of Americanized Judaism, which they call it Messianic Judaism. They don't call it Christianity. And the numbers in the last two decades, in the last 20 years, of Jews in Eretz Yisrael, not from Jews, generally not from, in Eretz Yisrael, it could be traditional Jews, by the way, but usually not people have a real solid education in Yiddishkeit that are going to these Messianic congregations is terrible. Now, I'm not trying to minimize the threat of atheism or other threats, but
you're saying it is a real threat in Eretz Yisrael.
Yeah, and well, here in America too. It's just that in America, people aren't so interested in spirituality altogether.
Well, Rabbi Blumenthal, thank you very much, and I ask everyone who's interested in this topic to Google or YouTube Rabbi Blumenthal, and you'll see some really excellent tapes on response to missionaries. Thank you very much, Rabbi Blumenthal.
Very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye.
Exciting group of guests and interesting topic. You know, we've built such a beautiful community. Look at our children. For the most part, I mean, do you know anybody whose kid has tattoos, who has maybe a pin going through their eyebrow or a nose ring, or heaven knows the things that people do today? Yeah, we all have issues, but look at it. And with beautiful families, beautiful children, our schools. My father says he remembers when he went to Tarvadas, there was a choice of two yeshivas in the country. I don't know what there are, but from when, if anybody gets the, you know, the collection letters before Rosh Hashanah, it seems certainly that there's 1,000. We've done a beautiful job. Community. When Rachman Olson, somebody gets sick, there's people to call, there's doctors, there's Bikur Chaim houses, there's all kinds of, you know, Satmara Bikur Chaim, there's friends come, there's Achlasas Kal. It's just a really special sense of love, devotion, community, Kehila Kedaisha. Mati Sushar tells me a story. He says he once stopped on the road for a flat tire. He says there was somebody, you know, with a yarmulke trying to, so he helped the guy, and then he said to the guy, oh, you know, the guy said, thank you, and he said, oh, you're welcome, which, you know, he started, and he realized the fellow was not from Amcha. So he said to the fellow, are you Jewish? He said, no. She said, so why do you wear a yarmulke? He said, my father taught me, always keep a yarmulke in your glove compartment in case you break down. So we have a really wonderful tzibur, a loving community. But sadly, you always have the poily oven. Those who take advantage, they scam, the Ponzi schemers, the molesters, those who make great chilul Hashems, who really do great damage to our community. They're destructive. The kids who are molested, their lives are never the change. They commit suicide. They leave. The scammers take people's money. I mean, unfortunately, there's few of them. But it's Amru called Payaleyav, and those who are Mesis and Medea who are. So she says, what should we do? How do we deal with them? The guy comes, he sits down in your shul. You just know that this guy's basically evaporated 1,000 almanis, yisayimim, tzedakas. He's made their money disappear into his pocket. You just say, okay, Beryl, you're here, you're sitting next to me, I'm going to look away. What do we say on those people? Do we say, you know, how do we don't want you part of our community, right? How do we deal with the Payale oven? You'll see it's Machlekes in the Shulchan Aruch, actually. There's two dais, and there's a Haskama of the Paiskim. We'll have on two fabulous Rabbanim. We actually have two victims speaking about it, two of the horrific victims. Fabulous show. Look forward to speaking to you again next week. This is David Lichtenstein for Headlines Radio.